Well, this week we're going to be looking at Exodus chapter 32. Last time we looked at Exodus 31, where God directed Moses to specific men to perform and oversee the construction of the tabernacle and its furniture. One was Bezalel. He was the grandson of Hur from the tribe of Judah. Hur was the son of Caleb. And so Bezalel was the grandson of Caleb. And God said he filled him with the Spirit of God, with wisdom, with understanding, with knowledge, and all kinds of craftsmanship. And so as he's prepared, he's going to be doing this work, not just for artistic sake, not just for expressing himself, but he will see how the work that he's doing will fit in with the worship of God, and it's God that's going to be honored in work, but that those things would point to God. And God intentionally prepared him for this task to be chief craftsman of the project. And so that's what he will be doing. And Aholiab was from the tribe of Dan, was also there going to help him. And God gave him skill, and also all the craftsmen that would be working on it, God gave them skill to make everything. So this is God's plan. He's provided the plan for it. He's also provided the workers. And then God took Moses back to the Sabbath, clearly once again directing that it be observed, that it's to be a time of complete rest, that the penalty for violation would be death. And this was to continue through all generations, and it's a covenant, God said. It's not just a command, but this is an agreement between them. And he connects it with creation and the 7 days of creation. We get into all these arguments about creation with people that want to tell us that we don't need to interpret Genesis as 7 days of creation. I'm reacting to that a little bit because there was a video that came by my attention earlier this week where a guy was talking about interpreting the Bible, and it looked interesting, so I turned to it. And all he did was spend his time telling people, you don't need to interpret that as 7 day creation. And then he kept going through other things in the scriptures that you can be a good Christian without believing those things. It just won't work because it undermines the whole being of God himself, and that he provided a written word, and that he really created this world. If he didn't create it, then why do we need to worry about him? I mean, you could start there, and you could also then extend it to Christ, because Jesus continually turned to this word and even to creation itself for part of what he taught. So it kind of got under my skin this week when I saw that. And then God gave Moses 2 tablets of the testimony. They were tablets of stone and written by the finger of God. And, you know, I thought about this as I was putting my review together. But when you say written by the finger of God, you know, on the artwork I've seen where people are imagining these stone tablets, most of the time, I won't say exclusively, they're roughly hewn. The characters are roughly carved out of the stone, and so on. And I have a feeling that if God did this himself and provided it to Moses, it was anything but roughly done. I'll bet you these were really something to see. Well, that takes us to chapter 32, and that's where we're going to start in today. So first of all, I'm going to read the first 10 verses, and we'll spend some time with them. So beginning in chapter 32 of Exodus 1 through 10, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us a god who will go before us.' And for this Moses, the man, and as for this Moses, the man who brought us up from that land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. Aaron said to them, 'Tear off your gold rings, which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me.' Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf, and have worshipped it, and have sacrificed to it, and have said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" The Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation." So, verse 1 starts off and said, the people saw Moses had delayed to come down from the mountain. Well, that's from their perspective, right? So what were they saying from their perspective? What are they saying?
Where's Moses?
He's yeah.
Been gone for too long.
Been gone for too long. How long was he on the mountain? 40 days and 40 nights. And so Moses was away for 40 days. And I wouldn't you, as with me, have to admit that this cloud, fire, all the things that were happening on the mountain for 40 days, after a while, that would seem like a long time for Moses to be up there when there was no expectation given. So in one sense, maybe we can understand that to a point. Now, the way they say it is that Moses had delayed. Did Moses delay? No, there was no delay on Moses' part. So they misunderstand at best what's going on. At worst, they really just said, it's been long enough, we're not comfortable. And so there they were saying, he's not here. And now, there's another piece I don't want to miss. Go back over to chapter 24 for a minute, because that's where this 40 days starts. And I want to make sure we have this in our thinking as we look through these verses. excuse me. In chapter 24, and I really didn't intend to look at all this, I guess, so I didn't write down the verses. But he had prepared them for his absence. How did he prepare them? Do you remember? Your eyes might quickly pick out the verses. I'm up front and thinking of other things, so I'm not going to see them as quick. What did he do to prepare for his being gone from the people?
He selected Aaron and Hur to lead them.
Yes, and God had told him to bring up some of the elders, right? So there's a group of elders, and he says, okay, I'm going up to the mountain. Who did he actually still take with him partway?
Joshua.
So he and Joshua are going to depart from them. And he says to those elders, hey, if there's a problem that comes up, here's how to handle it. And what did he tell them? What?
Let them approach them.
Aaron and Hur. So he had left Aaron and Hur there to take care of any problems. Specifically, that text says legal problems, right? What's the source of their legal functions at this point? What is their law? What basis are they going to decide any legal things? What had Moses just done in the days leading up to going on the mountain?
He had
met with God, and God had given him all of these laws, told him how to handle thievery, told him how to handle all kinds of things, including worshiping God, right? So Aaron and Hur, while I'm gone, if there's any issues, and he had brought this back to the people and read it to them, right? And how did the people respond? What you've said, we will do. And so he did all that to set the stage for going up on the mountain. He left Aaron and Hur in charge. And so Moses didn't come back as quickly as they had expected. And it's interesting, if we look behind that word delayed in the Hebrew, we find out that it can mean long, so Moses was there a long time. It can mean ashamed, which I don't see that one fitting, but I can also see confusion. Confusion is part of the nature of that word. And so you can expect them to say, this is confusing. Moses has been gone 40 days. What's happening? What do we need to do? And so what do they do? Well, what do they do?
They make a graven image.
Well, we got to back up a few steps. You're right. Let's back up a few steps. What's their first physical action?
They go to Aaron.
Before that. They assembled. We had one of those town meetings. I don't want to misrepresent or mischaracterize this, but it seems like that's a part of a lot of the old westerns, right? This isn't going right, so somebody gets everybody together and we're going to go do something. Storm the jail, burn them out, whatever it is. And so these people got together. Who was leading them, we don't know. But you know, in a group like this, and this is a big group, right, potentially? I mean, we don't know what percentage of the people showed up, but enough it just says the people gathered. So they're there, they've got this energy, and they go to Aaron. And they demand something of Aaron. And they demand what?
Make us gods.
Make a god for us. Who will what? What's this God supposed to do?
He's going to lead
him. Go before us. They're looking forward. They're looking for a God to follow. Now, how did they react when they came into the general presence of God, into the realization that God was on the mountain? What did they say to Moses when they heard God's voice speaking?
You talk to him. We don't want to have
anything. This God is too scary. We want nothing to do with him. We'll do what he says, but you go get the message and bring it to us. How scared are they of God right now? How could you be that concerned about having to interact with God and have pledged, we'll do what, yeah, we're going to do it. We'll follow this all the days of our lives. These commands will be part of our total future. And then 40 days later, don't know what happened to Moses. And first of all, that we would agree in a sense with the evidence that Moses was up there 40 days, right? We can get that. So we have the same evidence. Their conclusion, of course, we get to see through the scriptures what's really going on. But their conclusion is something bad must have happened. Now, that's pretty amazing when you consider what they've been through with the leadership of God bringing them to where they are. And all of the events and all of the things that God has done and directed them to, and even let them be criticized for their whining and complaining, no water, no meat, no food, and he provides it all. And then they get here, and after 40 days, they're going like, well, let's try a new God. Aaron, make us one. And they're looking forward. And this man who brought us up from Egypt, we don't know what became of him. Was that a truthful statement in its entirety?
They know what he would do.
Yes. But there's another part in that that's really important to realize just how they said it. That's not true. This man that brought us up out of Egypt, did this man bring us out of Egypt?
No.
As a matter of fact, if we go back and look at the history of it, when God said, hey, Moses, got a job for you. It'll be a lot of fun. Go bring him up out of Egypt. Moses didn't say, yeah, man, let's go. This is going to be great. No. Moses, the last thing he wanted to do was bring them up out of Egypt, and he had a whole box full of excuses. And then he gets over into Egypt. They bring about the first plague, or the first demand on Pharaoh, and what does Pharaoh do? Work harder, work harder, no straw. And God, and Moses is going back to God going, hey, they're upset, and so am I. This is not what we expected. Moses had to be led by God just as much as they did in certain ways. Moses got over his hesitancy to do what God said based on the burning bush and based on God coming to find him to kill him when he had not circumcised his young sons. And so Moses realized and followed then God's direction because he knew that God could not be crossed. But it wasn't Moses' power that brought him up. It was the power of God. And by the way, who was leading? Visibly, right? Pillar of fire, pillar of cloud. And so now all of a sudden they're going, this man that brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. And so there they are. How does Aaron respond to this? Make us a god. What does Aaron do?
Jumps on the wagon.
Okay, sure. Bring me all your gold. And they do, and really it was specific, bring me your gold rings from your ears, from your wives, your sons, and your daughters. And that was common practice then. Earrings were common, kind of like they are today. And so they brought him the gold. Now, what should Aaron have done at this point? We know what he did. What should he have done?
He tested the situation.
He should have what?
He should have told them all to stop what they're doing and think for a second.
You know that scary guy up in the cloud, God? I'm doing this. And you don't want to either. Yes, ma'am. Well, that's an interesting question. So there's two sides to that coin. Let's talk about that a minute. Could they have, by their own power and influence, turned this crowd for sure? No. But they sure didn't have to cooperate. And Aaron sure could have made a testimony here. I'm not doing this. You want to do this, you do it yourselves. But I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to wish you hadn't. And he should have marched off. Yes, sir.
Just a thought, too. I know we're going to get to this, but if we look at the result of the sin and the subsequent punishment that comes from it, we know that the rioting crowd really was a minority when it comes to the overall population of Israel. And so it really is a false assumption to assume that like they couldn't control the rioting crowd. At the end of the day, it's do we fear God or do we fear men?
That's
they
right.
They feared men. They made the idol. They did all that stuff instead of trusting that God would support them, and even should they have to kill, which they end up, they will have to kill them, they could have put this rebellion down, they could have squashed it.
They could have physically squashed the rebellion. We wind up making an assumption before we're done one of two ways, and you're right, we'll get to that. By the time it's done, it's a minority crowd. I don't know that necessarily all the way through it was a minority crowd, because you know how a minority crowd can dwindle. I mean, when the pressure comes, a lot of people disappear. And I really think it probably was. I agree with where you went, but I think we have to be a little bit careful with the text, because we're going to get to the crowd being 3,000 about. But along the way, who was there in between? Who were there that might have been people looking like bystanders that shouldn't have been bystanding? And so on, I don't know. We'll take a look at that. Large or small, Aaron should have held his testimony, and he should have said no in one fashion or another. But instead, he says, bring the gold. And he doesn't right off the bat say, wait a minute, I was there. Moses is not who brought you out of Egypt. It was Jehovah that brought you out of Egypt. So let's get that straight before we go any further. He could have recounted the miracles, starting with, I know how I got into this, God sent me to see Moses. And Moses wasn't across town, he was across the desert. And he could have brought many of those things together. And just a few days ago from chapters 20 through 26, Moses had read them these laws, he could have sent them back to them, including their commitment in chapter 27, we're going to follow those laws. Aaron could have brought all of that up. But instead he said, bring me your gold rings. They did. He took the gold rings in verse 4. And how did he make this calf? This golden calf.
He carved it himself.
He fashioned it with a carving tool or a graving tool, yes. And then the product when he got done was a molten calf. Why a calf? Well,
was the calf sacred or something to them?
Well, calves and bulls in particular, and for that matter, if we go to the Egyptians, even the female cows, they had gods that they believed in, that they followed, represented by, the Egyptians did, by bulls and by cows. Their bull god was Apis. Greek, it's hap or happy, H-A-P-I, not H-A-P-P-Y, stood for fertility, was seen as very involved in the underworld. If you hear that in what we're talking about here, we're really talking about what happens at death, resurrection, those kinds of things. And it was very ancient. I mean, this worship of bulls went back long before the Israelites showed up in Egypt and continued long after. Another place that you see a bull worshipped is Baal worship, which is up in Canaan. The bull symbolized who they were worshiping in the term of Baal, very evil, nasty deity that they invented for themselves. Another place is commonly throughout the Middle East, bulls were seen and worshipped for strength and prosperity. By the way, I'm going to tell you this in my research, trying to find out, okay, so what's going on with the calf and the bull? This is a very modern thing, too. The Hindus today have a cow and calf idol. They promote it strongly. You can buy them on Amazon and lots of other places. You can pay a lot of money for them. You can also buy them cheaply. They are considered to be gods that promote nurturing and abundance. You could take that another layer down, and some look at it for fertility and for purity. And while bumping into this in the research, I found lots of different folks that gave the instructions about where you place it in your home, which direction it needs to be pointed, and how you really get the power out of this god. So this isn't just something to think about in days of old. You may run into it today. Yes, sir.
On that bull, they often put a crescent symbol above the bull's head. That's in the Egyptian tombs. Interestingly enough, the Muslim religion picked up that crescent moon.
Mm-hmm. That crescent moon actually started out. The Egyptians were solar worshippers, worshipped the sun, that originally started out as a solar reflector. When they would build a bull-type idol with horns, they would put that solar reflector in the top because the ultimate source of all of this was the sun. And so that's why it was there.
I got one.
What's that?
I said I got one.
We might have to talk afterwards. No, go ahead.
You're saying the bull stands for strength and prosperity. You're making me think of a Christian religion we have that bumps real close to that, the health, wealth, and prosperity
yeah.
gospel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's out there. I mean, these things do, I don't know if I want to say these things, but Christianity lets itself be influenced by the world far too much. And so we may find ourselves talking to some folks that have an idol that looks like a bull one of these days. But these people, it says in verse 4, they said, who's they there? The people. So there's some voice in the people, these ones that are part of this rebellion. This is your God, O Israel. And now they're looking backwards. Who brought you up from the land of Egypt? Now, what did this golden idol have to do with bringing them up to Egypt?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Now, that's an interesting change in affirmation. Because earlier they said they came up by Moses. Now they say, well, no, it's really this thing that got us here. And so now they've got this bull there. Maybe they borrowed it from calf worship in Egypt, which, by the way, was very prolific. You would see drawings of calves or bulls on places that the Egyptians had worshipped. And so if they were bringing them out of Egypt, would the same Egyptian god bring them out of Egypt when it was the god of Egypt? No, but anyway. So they've got their idol there. Now when Aaron saw this, what did Aaron see in verse 5? When Aaron saw this, what's that?
He built an altar.
But what did he see?
People worshiping this calf.
Who's running Aaron? Yeah, fear of people or wanting to please people instead of wanting to please God. So when Aaron saw what they said, what did he do? Build an altar in front of it. And then he made a proclamation. This proclamation is very interesting. Tomorrow will be a feast to... And what does your Bible say?
The Lord.
And that is Jehovah. If you look back at the Hebrew, he said, tomorrow will be a feast to Jehovah. Now, what did he mean by this? And so now you can get some scholars that said, well, he really was just fashioning this gold calf so they'd have something visible to see to think about God. That is so ludicrous. Because... what was the commandments that were given in Exodus 20?
No other gods before me.
No graven images. And here he just made one. So that's ludicrous. Some say that, well, he was trying to push them back toward worshiping Jehovah. And that well may be. He may have said that out of guilt. It may be polytheism. Well, yes, we've got the golden calf, but we're also going to continue to worship Jehovah. None of these things would be acceptable in God's sight. They all would have been clearly said to be the sin against God according to the commandments that were given. And so they've got this statue there, and so that we're going to have this feast. And so the next day they did. What did they do at the feast? What was the first thing they did?
Made offerings.
Well, they had a burnt offering. What's the burnt offering typically for?
Peace offering.
No. The burnt one was first. The peace comes next.
Atonement.
That's atonement, forgiveness, some sort of sin. And then they had the peace offering. And the peace offering in itself usually had its own feast. Parts of the animals that were offered would be kept. And the idea is we're now at peace. So we're having this offering and this meal together to show that we're all at peace with you, the God that they offered it to, not just with each other. Now the question comes to be, well, what God are they thinking about when they make the burnt offering and the peace offering? And it's not said, but you can pretty much tell they're thinking about this golden calf. So this is a gross sin by Aaron and all there, because what did they do next? They feasted and then they rose up to play. That's a euphemism for some pretty wild, immoral conduct, which was normally a part of worship for these other gods that they were used to. or had seen before, or are typically represented by the bull. And so here they are, rising up to play, typical pagan worship words, sensuous, worldly, sinful. And now, in verse 7, we go back on the mountaintop.
I got a question, Rick.
Yeah.
I noticed in there's an interpretation difference between the NESB and the ESB on the number of gods. So they must be interpreting Elohim. One of them's interpreting it plural. The other one's interpreting it singular. So does that golden calf represent multiple gods, Elohim in the plural, or...
Well, I do start most of my study with the New American Standard, so your note's going to be in the
ESV,
and so the NASB didn't bring that up, so I didn't pick up on it. When I looked up the word in the tools to take me back to what's the Hebrew word, it just listed it as Elohim, with no comments of plurality or singularity, but Elohim, as it was represented all over the scriptures, and every time I've seen it, it's been singular in terms of the way it was put into English. They didn't give it a plurality. So I don't know. I don't have a clue. So which verse did they make that point in?
These are your gods, O Israel.
Oh, who brought you up?
Yeah, this was verse 4.
Okay, yeah, it would have been back and forth if it's this is your gods. I don't know. I mean, in one sense, it's an interesting question and deserves to be answered, and I don't have the answer standing here. On the other hand, it's still an interesting question, deserves to be answered, but it's not going to change the sin much. I mean, one or 50 gods being worshipped, or believing that there was some plurality of gods that brought them up out of Egypt, God's not going to accept to being part of some plurality in their minds. It's just not going to fly. So in that sense, I don't know. So good question, Bill. Wish I had an answer. Going back to verse 7, on the mountaintop, God says to Moses, go down right now, go down immediately, for your people whom you brought up from Egypt corrupted themselves. Interesting words. That isn't the way God talked about these people. There are many examples of God calling them my people. Now, there are other times he called them your people, but starting in Exodus 3, he says, I've seen the affliction of my people. And so that's what he tells Moses. Why he's sending them back. And the message to Pharaoh that Moses is to give is to let my people go. And the my there isn't for Moses, it's for God. And in chapter 8, thus says the Lord, let my people go. And so it just continues. Even in the laws, back in chapter 22, when he was giving those to Moses, says, if you lend money to my people, meaning fellow Jews, so my people. And so here he says to Moses, your people. They've quickly turned aside, God says, from the command that I gave them and have made a molten calf. They have worshipped it. And now we know for sure how God saw it and what really was going on. It for sure was a sacrifice to that calf. They have sacrificed to it. They have said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from Egypt. And so we have this really difficult thing going on about Moses being told about the way these people have done this. And earlier in Exodus 29, there were some specific sacrifices to be made in the tent of the meeting. God is saying, and I'm going to dwell among the sons of Israel, so they shall know I am the Lord their God. I am Jehovah their God, who brought them out of Egypt that I might dwell among them. I am their Lord and their God. And so this language of saying to Moses, your people, when just in chapter 29, as he's explaining to Moses how they're going to establish these sacrifices, it will be because they're his people. Then we get to verse 9, and we have to agree with God in this. Lord said to Moses, I have seen these people, behold. This is an exclamation point at the front of the sentence. Behold, they are an obstinate people. And that means hard or difficult or stiff-necked. They are difficult. They can wear you out. In verse 10, he says, now then, meaning time-wise, at this point in time, now, God says to Moses, let me alone. And why does he tell Moses to leave him alone? It's more than I'm angry, so that my anger can be put into action, can burn against them, that I may destroy them. And then what does he say to Moses?
I'll make a great nation.
Wow, that's a swap, isn't it, right here? So God said, yeah, I'm going to destroy these, and we'll let you be the great nation. And so that's how we left it off in verse 10. Let's take a look at verses 11 through 18. Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself, and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all the land which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. Then Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on one side and on the other. The tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Now when Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's a sound of war in the camp. But he said, it's not the sound of a cry of triumph, nor is the sound of the cry of defeat, but it's the sound of singing that I hear. So Moses hears this from God. Moses has just said, leave me alone so my anger can burn and I'll destroy them. I'll make you a great nation. How did Moses respond to that? Did he say, all right, let's get started. I'm ready to be head of a great nation. No. He said, why does your anger burn? And he starts out with him by name, Jehovah. Why does your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? What's his point there?
These are your people, not mine.
You got this wrong. They're your people. They belong to you. And you have said that over and over, Lord. So why are you so angry? They're your people. You brought them out of Egypt. You exercised this power. And so he's contrasting his language with God's. It's like a subtle, semi-subtle reminder. You said my people. No, they're your people. That's what you have declared them to be. That's also, he's going to say later on about some promises. But first he says, you know what the Egyptians are going to say? That you had evil intent when you brought them out. That you brought them out to slay them in the mountains and to wipe them from the face of the earth. And is that potentially a very true statement, if God had wiped them out?
Yeah, you know, I find that interesting, because God has basically said, I'm going to break my covenant with Abraham.
Yeah. Now, we're going to play with that language a little bit later, because I think we really need to understand this pretty carefully. But, so Moses then says, they're your people, the Egyptians will talk, the testimony will be that you are a God with evil intent, So turn from your burning anger. Change your mind. Don't harm your people. So Moses is affirming to God they're yours and you're going to be blamed. And therefore, that's the basis, he says, of my plea that you not harm them. But he keeps going. And he says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself, because there was nothing higher to swear by, saying to them, I'm going to multiply your descendants of the stars of the heavens, and all of this land that I have spoken about, I will give to your descendants. They will inherit it forever. So what did Moses do? He took him back to the promise to Abraham and said, essentially, you're going to break that promise? And so there's a few things that Moses doesn't say in his response. I think we ought to note that too. He doesn't say in his response, you're right, they've been terrible. From the beginning, there's been no faith. They've been accusatory. They're whiners. They're blamers. They think the worst of me. They think the worst of you. Every time something happened, they go, what'd you do? Bring us out here to die? There weren't enough graves in Egypt. You offer great miracles, and yet their trust can be measured in days. They don't stick with it. Moses could have said, yeah, and I will raise my kids to be better than those kids. But that isn't the path he takes, is it? You think this might have been partly a test for Moses? Could be. I'm not going to affirm that I know it was. But God sure put one out in front of him. I'm going to take Abraham out and substitute in Moses. How'd that be? But Moses doesn't go there. And he doesn't go there because he knows for God to be credible, for God to be who he claimed he was, and he knew that God was who he said he was, the promises are going to remain in effect. He agreed to save these people. He agreed. He proclaimed to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your descendants are going to live in this land. Everything that's here, all the land you've walked, all that you can see is going to be theirs, and it's going to be theirs forever. And so he knows God enough to know that that's what it has to be. So in verse 13, it says, the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. So does God go back and forth? Was God surprised by what the people did? He knew that before he ever brought them out of Egypt. And so what's all this language about? Leave me alone that I can do harm to them. Well, if we look at those verses, back in verse 9, actually 10, leave me alone that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. There's nothing in there that's truly a proclamation. He even says, if you don't go away, I'm going to have trouble doing this. So leave me alone so this can be explored and maybe done. And God clearly had no intention of doing that, did he? But he sure let Moses know what the people deserved. And he even held out for Moses the temptation to be the new Abraham. And Moses rejects it, and Moses goes back to the promise, and this is exactly what God wants to build the nation on. It was when Abraham left for the very first time, and God said, go, and he said to his wife, we're going. And Sarah said, where? He says, I don't know, but we're going. From that day forward, God had been laying the groundwork to establish this nation, and it was going to be established based on the promises and who he was and how he was unchanging yesterday, today, and forever, and faithful, and their role as being proclaimers of Jehovah as the one true living God. And here is Moses clearly showing his readiness to lead the people into the next phase of all this by going right to that when God says, here's a moment that they deserve to die. And he says, no, can't be. It can't be because of your own testimony, your own reputation in the world, your own consistency of who you are and the promises you've made. Please, God, don't undo those things about yourself. Moses put his argument to be based on the character and nature of God and his promises. That's what he argued for, to take God away from this talk of anger and destruction. Now, what do you think? Yes?
So, I kind of want to clarify, because, I don't know, I guess I'm a little confused. That's a lot to, wrap my head around. So, it wasn't really he was going to do it. It was a test, almost.
I think it was more than the test. I think in that moment, God was very, very, very angry. And he revealed to Moses that if it weren't for these other things, here's what would happen. Moses brought the other things back in. I think that pleased God very much. He didn't turn from his anger because Moses pleased God. He turned from his anger because Moses brought up the very divine reasons why he couldn't do that. And it wasn't that he couldn't do it because he didn't have the power. It wasn't that he couldn't do it because it would have been just in and of itself. He couldn't do it because he had made promises and he didn't change. He honored those promises and so on. Yes, sir.
I got a couple of thoughts, too. I think the first is to understand that in the light of God's nature, there are no potentialities.
That's right.
And so when we look at this passage, we really have two categories that we can view this passage in. We can say God has these two potential routes, and he's testing Moses about which route he's going to take, and then he's going to take that. That's not true.
That's not true, right.
Moses would be a cause, and God is not influenced by any cause outside of himself. And so we have to look at this passage in a different way, because it can't be that way. And so the question is, how do we look at this passage? And I think that it makes a lot more sense if we look at the passage as if God is explaining how he relates to his people in a way that humans can understand. So anytime God communicates to us in the scriptures, he has to communicate in a way that we can understand. And the way that he communicates in this passage is through what's called an anthropomorphism.
Mm-hmm.
And what basically that means is that God is relating to us by describing himself and his nature in a way that relates to human capacity. So, for instance, I'll give you another example. In many places in the scriptures, God says that he will make his face shine upon you, right? Does that mean that his face is actually shining upon you? No. It's a way that he describes how his nature, his beneficent nature, looks at people who are redeemed by Christ, who are walking in the way. And so I think when we look at this passage, we take it into consideration that it's not him describing that he actually repented, that he was going to go down this one path, and that he changed his mind, and that he's doing this other thing. No, he's describing to us his nature, how he abhors the sin of the people, and the, like you said earlier, the potential or the deserved judgment that those people deserve. But he is giving them grace. He's giving them mercy through the intercession of Moses, and he's really fulfilling a couple of different things. He's setting up for the future in Moses a way that Christ can be that Moses can be a type of Christ. Mm-hmm. Right, so that Christ can intercede on behalf of his people, and that God's wrath can be taken away from his people and be placed on his own son. Right, so I think that there's a number of different things we need to consider.
Yeah, and we're not going to get to that latter one today. There just isn't enough time. But you're right, because before we're done, Moses is going to be basically saying, "I'm on the people. If you're not going to save them, you can't save me either." But that's further down the road. Yeah, and you're right, getting your head around this is tough, because I not only had to figure it out for myself, but I had to figure out how to say it. And I got some good help here right now, but the bottom line is, I do think God was angry. We make God angry with our sin. And I do think God, in a sense, changed his mind, but not in the way we think of changing minds. I don't mean that he intended to go here, but after he heard Moses, he said, no, I'll change my intention and go here. But I think there was a period of time in here where God's energies for himself personally, what was on his mind was this anger over this sin. And then Moses talks to him And so he backs off of putting his energies into thinking about the anger, into thinking about going forward and how we're going to go forward. The people, there are going to be consequences from this sin, some pretty significant before we're done, significant ones before we're done.
Doesn't the whole generation die out in the wilderness too?
Well, yeah, I mean, we they're not done sinning and God's not done judging, even though he's going to keep his promises. God can judge and still keep his promises, and God will indeed do that. I want to give you a couple of verses that I hope would help us to realize God never changes his mind. Look at James 1:17. Turn over there if you would, please. James 1:17. And this doesn't say it quite as completely and firmly, but it's one of my favorite verses, so I decided to use it. And I wrote down a page number wrong, so let's go over to James. Wrong way. Now I can't find James. Well, anyway, instead of me turning past it three more times, somebody read for us James 1:17. Who's got that?
Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the heaven of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning.
It's that last part. God doesn't change. There's no, not even at the shadow level. He's the Father of lights. There's no shifting. It's not like done with lights and mirrors. It's done in clarity, with fullness. God lives it out that way, and he doesn't shift around. The shadows don't move. Then go over to Isaiah 46:8-10. Isaiah 46:8-10. And if you really stop and think about this, it'll start to blow your mind in another way. 46:8-10, Isaiah. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to your mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past. For I am God and there's no other. I am God and there's no one like me. This is the key verse. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. God determines the end from the beginning. And when you start thinking about that, particularly when you get down into details, that is an astounding verse. It helps us understand Ephesians 1:4. He chose us in him before the foundations of the world. He established the end from the beginning. I think it would be even be fair to say he wrote Revelation before Genesis was penned. He established the end from the beginning. And so when he's there in front of these Israelite people, he already knows what the end is. Now he made it express to Moses, I'm really upset here. And it might express it in strong terms. And Moses might interact with him on them, and through that get the whole idea of who God is and what's happening with this Exodus firmly understood. So let's go on. Verse 15. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of testimony written on both sides. They were God's work, as we said earlier. I really believe that they were something fantastic to see. I would like to be able to have seen them. Joshua's with Moses. Joshua begins to hear noise. What does he assume? Hey, well, we've been up on the mountain. They got embroiled in some military thing. And Moses said, no, it's singing. That's what I hear. It's not cheering of triumph. It's not wails of delight. It's singing. They're partying. They're having a drunken party. And that's what Moses is hearing as he comes down the mountain. And next week, we'll find out what he does. So, thank you for your attention this morning. These weren't really necessarily easy things, and they get harder when you isolate them to the moments they're happening. But when you take a few steps back and realize who God is and how he does business, not quite as hard. Anyway, next time.